Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom, where we examine the art and science of games. I'm Josh Beiser, and this week I'm recording this the week of Thanksgiving, and this is actually podcast number 3. So my voice is probably on me a few times tonight. But we've got a great cast for you. Unfortunately, James is big family and all that, so this set of casts, he won't unfortunately be able to make it, but we have a great one nonetheless. My guest is returning fan of the site and the lead designer and owner of Zachtronics. He's of course made games like Infinite Factory, Space Chem, TIS 100, and the game we're going to be talking about, Shenzhen IO. So please welcome to the podcast this week, Zach Barth. Hey, Zach, it's great to catch up with you again. How's everything
good.
Going?
Actually, so when you introduced me as the lead designer and owner of Zachtronics, I actually don't own Zachtronics anymore. We're part of a bigger studio team now. So, but we're still operating independently as Zachtronics.
All right. Yeah. Congratulations on that. So it's been, with the video game industry, it seems like time has no meaning. It feels like I don't even know the last time we saw. I think it's been at least, I want to say a year since we last spoke.
Probably, yeah. I actually worked at Valve for about 10 months in between the last time we spoke. Yeah, we shut down the studio, like last summer. And then I worked at Valve for a bit on VR and like on the Vive and on the Lab. Mm-hmm. And then it was probably like 6 months ago, we sold Zachtronics to a distributor, publisher, developer company, and then we came back, and that was when we started working on Shenzhen IO. We've been busy.
Right. Yes, I know. I have had the feeling of that too. We've been busy here with the YouTube channel, and like I was telling Zach before the cast, this again being recorded on Thanksgiving week, I'm supposed to be relaxing this week, and I'm just doing podcast after podcast. So I won't be able to talk, I think, by Friday at this rate. But I know, obviously, since we are recording this, we are actually literally recording this the day before Thanksgiving. I know, Zach, you are very busy today, so this won't be as long as one of our regular casts, especially since we've spoken so many times. But we definitely have some great topics to talk about. So I guess the first one, I guess, to just finish wrapping up with you, Zach. So for those of you listening, at the time of this recording, Shenzhen IO was just released, or I'm sorry, it was just taken off of Early Access and put to 1.0. Yes. So definitely congratulations for you for that one. I guess to get things rolling, then we'll move into talking about Shenzhen, and then we'll talk a little bit more about sort of how you've been finding the Early Access process. So for people listening to this cast who haven't been keeping up with Zachtronics or know what Shenzhen IO is, could you tell them a little bit about what the game is?
Oh yeah, I can try at least. So Shenzhen IO is sort of like a spiritual successor to TIS 100 in that it's a lot of games are about concepts that are similar to programming, but a few of them, including TIS and Shenzhen, are actually about programming. So you actually type characters and enter commands and execute those programs. And so this is actually a bit of a, honestly, like it's a bit of a diversion from the usual Zachtronics puzzle games, which were often more about like kind of visual metaphors for programming. Yeah. TIS was an accident. It wasn't really something that I intended to release as a game, just something I was just kind of screwing around with. And it turned out that like a lot of the things we learned from making the like symbolic visual Zachtronics games like actually transfer well into literal programming games. And so Shenzhen was sort of a spiritual successor to that, kind of exploring. Like TIS was a small game, it was pretty limited. With Shenzhen, we explored a lot more things that are kind of tangential to that. Instead of merely writing code, you're writing code on chips that you put in electrical circuits, and so you're doing both fake electronics and fake programming. And one of the big things about the game is the manual. It comes with a 40-page manual, which we strongly encourage that you print out for the designer. And it creates something where, like the game spans both your computer screen and something that's physical in front of you. And I think it's probably the most interesting part about Shenzhen is that like a lot of games come with feelies now. Like if you get the deluxe edition, you get like stupid knickknacks and statues and helmets and flasks you can't drink out of. and right, like you get all these little like doodads, like little tchotchkes, but like they don't do anything. But with Shenzhen.io, like, you actually have this manual that you've either, like, purchased from us, for, like, in the limited edition that we did at launch, or you assembled your own from what you, like, the PDF that the game comes with. And, like, the game really does take place in this book. That there are puzzles that require you to search through the book looking for the relevant information. I was reading the article you wrote where you were talking about how the Shenzhen.io tutorial is terrible because it requires you to look stuff up in a manual and the manual's in the wrong order. And it's interesting because to us, the manual is not the tutorial. The only tutorial in Shenzhen.io is the first puzzle, which shows you what a solved puzzle or a partially solved puzzle looks like to establish sort of the goals of the game. But the manual itself is actually a puzzle. Right. And this is sort of example. I think it's best, like, the best example of this is that we have, like, supplemental data at the end of the manual, which is where a puzzle will say, oh, look at this, like, just find this page in the manual, and this is important for solving the puzzle. And you flip to the page, and it's just like, it's a diagram, and you have to, like, look at the diagram and understand what it's representing and how that translates into the puzzle space of the game. And, like, it is very much, it is meant to be, like, slightly obscure in some cases. And it's also our primary storytelling method, that it's a collection of documents that come from a bunch of different sources. And so you learn a lot about the world by looking at these documents and reading them, but they're also, like, actually technical. And so it's not just fluff, it's all useful stuff. And we've kind of gotten into this area of design where we're really trying to make something that is, like, we pay attention to detail and try to make something that's plausible and believable and, like, an authentic experience for these sort of things, technical systems.
Shenzhen.io has definitely become a favorite of my friends, especially those who have programming backgrounds and looking for something to flex their muscles. And just like with your previous games, the histograms are always a great way of just seeing how much you suck or how much your friends are, like, 50 cycles or whatever better than you. And then you're just, like, sitting there going, how the hell did they solve this damn puzzle like that?
Absolutely.
And I'm glad that you brought the manual, Zach, because I was also going to bring that up here. Because it is, as you said, it's just a very integral part of the game, just like it was in TIS 100. But it's really taken to a whole nother level here. As you said, it becomes essentially its own element of the game. And I got to a few of those puzzles myself where it just says, you know, go to page 36 and look at the diagram for help. And then I saw, like, a puzzle, like, oh, you just use, like, a basic geometry to solve it. I'm like, oh, God, I can't do geometry. And I cursed your name for a few minutes at that point.
One of the big things is that we actually try to – we do try to keep any sort of outside knowledge out of the game. And so you'll find very few math problems in the game. Like, with the exception of that, there is one math problem at the very end of the game when you get to the very hard puzzles that asks you to find the distance between two points, which requires the Pythagorean theorem. And that is all. And that it's actually really important for us to keep any kind of math out of it and for us to keep any kind of outside programming knowledge out of it. So, like, there's no, you're not writing JavaScript in this game. We don't need you to, you come in, like, you can't come into this game knowing how to program, like, in Shenzhen.io assembly, because it doesn't exist outside of the game. And that's a super important thing.
And that actually takes me to a good question that I want to ask you about, Zach. Just like with TIS 100, as you just said with Shenzhen, they both feature their own form of pseudocode to work with in the game.
Yes.
Obviously, with your background as a programmer as well, how did you, like, decide, I guess, essentially creating this kind of pseudo-language for the game? Like, what you wanted the player to use? And I know a few of my friends, like I said, who have a programming background, were thrown off by the unique quirks of the game. How did you kind of, like, decide, I guess, the rules of your own pseudo-language?
Yeah, I mean, it is a real programming language, right? I mean, it's it can't necessarily do everything you would do on another system. The way we designed it was we started by designing what it had to do. And I think it's important to note that programming languages are tools invented by people. All programming languages are, in fact. And, you know, programming languages are invented to design to solve they're a tool that is invented to solve a specific problem. So BASIC was invented as a programming language that would be easy to learn. And that's why a lot of the commands look like English and it doesn't have a lot of extra symbols in it. It was also something that was made to run on the computers at the time. If you look at, like, there's a lot of, like, there's a notion of, like, domain-specific languages. Like, you have languages like R that were designed They were designed, like, the language and the runtime environment were designed to solve, like, statistical math, kind of do math stuff, right? MATLAB has its own programming that's kind of well-suited to doing MATLAB math stuff. So programming languages are designed to solve tools. And so the first thing we figured out is, like, well, what is our electrical simulation like? What kind of problems are people going to have to solve? For Shinjin.io, it was, you know, saying that, okay, you have this notion of timing graphs over time, right? So, like, signals that go up and down over time and data that comes in over time. And you process these input signals and generate output signals. And it's very important that it takes place over time. So you need to be able to accurately count time. You need to be able to say, turn on an output for 2 cycles and then turn it off for another 2 cycles and then do that over and over again. And so once we established those requirements, we were able to sketch out the idea for a language that supported all of those things. Mm-hmm. And so, like, of course, like, a sleep instruction is going to be really important because we want people to be able to have control over time passing and tell when time passes. Mm-hmm. We also need instructions and like registers and stuff to allow people to interact with, the circuits. Mm-hmm. And so we sort of, like, it flowed back and forth between, you know, what do we want the non-programming aspects to be, and then how do we shape the programming language to make that possible, and then how do we sort of tweak the environment to match what the programming language does. And there's a lot of back and forth. We actually made a lot of really big changes to the programming language over the course of the game, as we realized that, like, some things that we want the player to be able to do are too hard with the way the language works now, so we need to redefine the language to be more expressive or to be, you know, better at something. There's a lot of cases of stuff where we redesigned that. One of the big fun things that we designed in the language is that actually when we started the language, the way that you did conditionals, so, like, if statements, you know, like, if this then that, they were exactly what they were in TIS 100. And about halfway through the game, we were like, wow, like, this is actually really tedious. It's too much like TIS 100. It's not fun. And an idea that we had kind of pitched around early on, which is the idea of using, like, well, what if every statement could be conditional based on a prior test? You put, like, a symbol in front of a line. And it either makes it so it does it when the test passed or when the test failed or all the time. And this is actually a thing that is present in a lot of real life programming languages. So we were very much, we did not invent this. It was inspired by, you know, like ARM, like the ARM assembly language for, like, phones and stuff. Like, various flavors of that support conditional instructions, like what we have. There's, like, some other, like Intel, I think it's like the Xeon or one of the Intel processors that was used in servers supports this. So we were like, oh, that's perfect. Like, this actually makes it really easy to write these kind of things that we want to, you know, it makes it easy to solve the problems that we want players to be able to solve easily. And so it went into the language. And so it's very much, like, we didn't design a general purpose programming language. We designed one specifically for the game, specifically to solve the kind of problems we wanted players to solve, and specifically to make the things we wanted to be easy, easy, and the things we wanted to be hard, hard. And so I think this is where you, in order to do something like this, you have to be both a programmer and a game designer.
Finish your thought. Yeah.
Oh, I was just going to say, there's this quote from Elon Musk where he talks about, like, the way you make great things is by being an expert at two things. Not that I think I'm an expert, but just the idea that when you're an expert in two domains, you can have what he calls idea sex, which is where two ideas have sex and make hot, like, you know, like, sexy idea babies, which are the fusion of two different disciplines. And I think that's, it's that kind of that cross-disciplinary, a normal person would call it cross-disciplinary, you know, like, studies or whatever, cross-disciplinary work. I think that that's, like, an essential part of understanding sort of where our game designs come from, is that cross-disciplinary. I am both a programmer and a game designer, and lousy at both, but it works together well.
Yeah. So. And again, with a game like Shenzhen.io, as you were just saying, Zach, it's very fascinating to see how sort of the programming becomes essentially its own puzzle. We saw this in the same kind of breath with TIS 100, but then you throw in the electronics side of things, and as you said, a lot of the challenge of the game was figuring out what you wanted the player to do, would the language be able to satisfy that, and then we go an additional layer, is the language able to make this, you know, is this going to be an easy solution with the language? Is it going to be a hard solution with the language? Because as you said, when you're building this program, when you're building your own language or your own assembly, you could have a command that says, you know, immediately solve this specific situation.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
But then, of course, is that going to make the game too easy or too hard? Or do you have that ability in there, but is it kind of hidden within the other commands that you've built into the game?
Exactly. That's the kind of stuff we have to keep in mind, and like, you know, that's what requires us to change puzzles, whether to make them easier or harder. There's a lot of stuff that we don't anticipate happening that happens, and especially in a game like this, like I do not claim to be smart enough or clever enough to predict what these rules we make are going to, what effects they're going to have. Like, to some degree we can, but players do crazy stuff, and like the sort of the dream is that we can create these emergent rules that are interesting, but like structured in a way such that we can prevent people from doing things that totally break the game without making it feel like we just slapped on a rule for no good reason. I feel like unintuitive rules that are meant to like keep people from exploiting it, like that's bad for everybody. Like, only a few people were trying to exploit it, but everybody loses because suddenly it's way more confusing. And so trying to figure out like one of the things in Shenzhen that was really difficult to design around is we wanted to make it so people could write a value out to like a simple IO pin and it would just like keep putting out that value, because that's like a very common thing in electronics. So we wanted to try to replicate that. The problem is that that's a place where you can store values. And if every IO pin is also usable as a place where you can store values, suddenly like the register scarcity aspect of the game, where you only have like a few variables that you can store data in, goes away because you have so many variables. And so trying to come up with rules that are intuitive, but still prevent people from exploiting the game, like there's a lot of, it's a delicate balance. There's lots of compromises.
Yeah, I bet we could easily just sit here for like 2 days talking about all the changes and things that were added and altered throughout Shenzhen's development.
Yes, there's a lot that went into it.
I guess here's a general question. I'm not sure if you've thought about this or if there's an easy answer to it, but I'm just curious. As we said, you've designed all the puzzles for the game. How long does it like normally take you to build a puzzle like this for Shenzhen IO?
Oh, that's a good question. So the way I build puzzles for this game, both sort of logically and technically, is that I come up with an idea. I always design everything on paper at first. So the level editor, quote unquote, that we shipped for Shenzhen IO to build a community generated set of puzzles was just a sheet of paper that has like all the like stuff that you can fill out by hand on it. And it's funny because that's actually the same level of technology that we use, is that I like to design all my levels on paper because then I can put them all side by side on our conference table and sort of try to sort them by what I think the difficulty will be. And I can toss out the ones that are bad or replace them with ones that are good. It's a good way to organize these kind of thoughts. So I'll start by, you know, sketching a puzzle out on paper that probably takes like an hour. It depends on if the idea that I started with was good or bad. Sometimes like in the process of sketching out a puzzle, you're like, oh no, there's no way this will work or this doesn't make sense. But if it does, I'll then take it and enter it into the game. And that in all of our, we're all, like everybody who's actually building the game generally knows how to program at Zachtronics. So all of our levels are implemented as code, and specifically, the inputs and outputs for a puzzle are generated procedurally by a function that generates a random set of inputs and outputs that is valid. And that's how we can have 80 different test cases for every puzzle without having to make them all by hand. And so what I'll do then is I'll take the puzzle description that I did on paper and attempt to actually implement something that generates input-output test cases. And a lot of times that's where I would actually discover like, wow, this is way too hard. Like, I sort of have to solve the puzzle in C# in order to generate the correct output from the desired inputs. And so that actually gives me sort of like a first glance into how computationally complex the puzzle is. And then I can kind of think about like, oh, this actually seems like it'd be really hard to implement using the game's, you know, like tools that we give you, or maybe it's not. And so like that usually the laser tag puzzle that I added probably took me like an entire day to implement that and like get it actually to something that I was happy with. And then I still had to change it later. So like that's kind of the upper bound, is like a day to implement a puzzle. On a good day, I could probably, like when we were actually like deep in development, I probably could do like 5 puzzles a day. They take longer than I think they will to do, but still shorter than other people probably take to design puzzles. Our puzzle design theory, like philosophy, is kind of just like, just kind of fire something out and then we'll see how difficult it is. But some people, like I imagine Jonathan Blow takes 10 times as long to make a puzzle as I do, just because his stuff is so much more deliberate. And the stuff that I make is actually relatively just like, I don't know, like it's, it's empirical puzzle design. I don't know.
And you made a really good point a few seconds ago, Zach, when you were talking about trying to decide like what puzzles are too easy, what puzzles are too hard. I wanted to come back to that because that's a very interesting point, especially about puzzle design and game development. As we've seen, there are most puzzles in games when we're talking about like different rules and different kinds of theories can be very subjective. I know there are some puzzles in games that I get through, like, you know, it's completely easy, and then there are some that I get stuck at, and basically I have to go find an FAQ somewhere to solve. So my question for you, I guess, in your opinion, how do you decide, like, what's an easy puzzle in a game like Shenzhen, and what would be considered a hard puzzle?
So, to some degree, there's a theoretical understanding. I have, like, a theoretical understanding of difficulty. Mm-hmm. Like, I can kind of, if I designed a system and spent enough time with it, I can kind of look at a puzzle and just kind of be like, like, you can quickly tell, like, oh, like, in order to do this, you would need to do a technique like this, you know, and I can kind of eyeball this stuff, and that's why this method that I use kind of works, is that I can eyeball it. But you actually really often need to test it, right? And so by having one person play through the level, I can kind of get an idea of sort of like what's going on in their head, and if there's like obvious pitfalls that I think a lot of people would fall through, like fall for. In general, the way we look at difficulty is just looking at metrics. Mm-hmm. We collect metrics about playtime on puzzles, and we can tell how many people. The metric we use now is our dominant metric, is how many people played this puzzle, didn't solve it, and then stopped playing the game because of it. And it turns out, we learned at Infinifactory when we did surveys, we actually had surveys offer through early access, that one of the questions we had is, after you beat a puzzle, did you think that puzzle was too easy, just right, or too hard for like where it was in the game? Mm-hmm. And that actually tracked the number of people saying a puzzle was too hard versus too easy, tracked very closely, close enough for us to care, with the the externally measurable metric of how many people bounced off a puzzle, which is to get to it and then never beat it. And so if a lot of people bounce off a puzzle, that actually tells us that a lot of people, you know, who did solve it probably thought it was too hard. It's probably too hard. And the reality of a game like any of our games is that, like, no puzzle is solved by 100% of people. I mean, we have a less than 100% like rate of solution on the first puzzle in Shenzhen IO, right? It's probably only like 95% of people who try that puzzle solve it, and so we are always losing people. The question is just like, are we losing too many? And that's like, no game has, like, very few games have 100% completion rate. Certainly not ours. And so we can actually tell exactly like where we lose the people. And the thing that we kind of say is like, okay, are we losing too many people on this puzzle relative to the other puzzles? Honestly, like in all of our games, we probably lose like 20% of players on every puzzle, right? So every puzzle, that just the number of people that are coming through to the end gets smaller and smaller and smaller. That, like, of like the, I was looking at the metrics the other day, like 30,000 people beat the first puzzle. By the time you get to the end of the first campaign, that number drops down to like 1,500, like 30, you know, like, so we're down to like 5%. And then by the time you get to the end of the, like the second campaign, we've dropped down to like another 5% of the people who started it. Right. So we lose a tremendous number of people through all of our puzzles. And like, to some degree, that means that like our game is too hard, but like the difficulty is also the defining aspect of the game. So like, it's only too hard if it's hitting the bottom line.
Yeah, and that's always the very interesting thing about your game, Zach, that I think we talked about this on an earlier podcast. I know I've certainly made a post about how a lot of the puzzles in your game are built on the subjective knowledge of the person. If you have someone who has a strong background in programming, who understands the concepts and the theories, they're going to most likely just skyrocket through your puzzles. And then for someone new, it's going to be a lot harder. If they can learn things, like, a lot of the puzzles in your game, as you said, are built on understanding different kinds of concepts or different kinds of programming solutions. The quicker you learn them, the easier it will be. But if you don't learn them or you can't figure them out, as you said, the wall goes up, essentially.
Yeah, you do. Like, the game does require learning, for sure. Like, there are real skills that you need to acquire. One of the things we do is we try to actually design things in a way to scramble the knowledge of people who already know how to program. And so, like, that's why I would never do something like use JavaScript in a programming game, right? Because that would, like, it basically says, hey, there's no learning required for somebody who knows JavaScript, and there's tons of learning required for somebody who doesn't. So instead, like the use of our conditional instructions, like, there are very few programmers who actually have any kind of experience with something like that.
Yep.
Right. And so nobody gets to come in understanding how that works. Everybody has to learn the ins and outs of it. The one thing I think is that to some degree, being a good programmer means that you have to know how to teach yourself things. And so I think that some people who have programming experience are perhaps like better at teaching themselves things, and they're more familiar with sort of computational thinking. And to some degree, I think that's true about all games, right? Like if you're playing a strong understanding of computational thinking would help you in Portal too, right? Just because you're able to think like, okay, like you're able to set up logical dependencies in your head and think, oh, in order to do that, I need to do this first. But then this is gated by this other thing under these conditions, and sort of like navigating through those systems. There is some transferability like between other skills in real life and playing those games. But that's sort of just an aspect of puzzle games, right? Like, or good puzzle games, maybe. Non-riddle games. I don't know. it's just a thing. Yeah, I don't know. I think puzzle games as a genre is sort of a poor choice. they're demanding in a way that many other games are not nowadays, and it's sort of a debate, an open question, whether that's a good idea to make puzzle games or not.
And as we said, with your games, they are definitely on the niche end of even the puzzle genre itself, with, again, the layers of complexity and the challenges that the players has to learn. I think what you just said is a really good point about the fact that a lot of what makes these games challenging, again, is having to essentially teach yourself the rules and mechanics. As we said, I think on our last interview, we talked about Infinifactory and how it's built on, again, like the assembly line, understanding that kind of the machinations behind it, and then having to apply that to something that literally doesn't exist. Like, we're not making assembly lines in Infinifactory like we do in real life, but the theories and the practicality of it does work. It's the same thing as we just said with TIS 100 and Shenzhen. You're not going to take what you learn in Shenzhen and go to a job and say, this is my experience in programming, but the learning and the thought process behind it, though, are important skills to have.
Yeah.
A friend of mine, I was telling him about the game, and he was joking, saying, does that game end with, like, a job interview? Like, if you beat Shenzhen IO, does it, like, load up to a company site and say, okay, submit your resume, you're ready for us?
The funny thing is there are a lot of services like that out there. Maybe not a lot. There are some. There are some sites that say, hey, here's some programming challenges, and if you can solve them, well, it'll get your foot in the door at a job. But yeah, I think it's debatable whether anything like this actually would help, like, select for good candidates for a job. Programming in real life is nothing like programming in our games, which I think is part of the appeal.
Yeah, definitely. And that could easily take us, like, another hour if we could talk about that. I know we are approaching the half hour mark, so I do want to move on to our final topic. Again, for the folks listening, we're trying to be a little bit quicker on this one. Again, this is holiday week, so everyone is getting busy. So, I guess to wrap up talking about Shenzhen, as we said, the game officially came out of early access. I think it's been, would you say about like 2 weeks like from our recording?
Yeah, so the game came out in early access on October 6th, and then we left early access on November 17th, so about 6 weeks later.
Now, obviously, it's too soon to tell, I guess, the overall impressions of the game, but I guess for you guys, what are you, I guess, consider, like, finished with Shenzhen, or are you planning on doing some post-release support? Because I know with Infinifactory, you did release several more campaigns after its release.
During early access?
Oh, yeah.
We actually didn't do anything after we left early access.
Okay.
Same thing with TIS. So our strategy for the past three games has been release the game into early access in a very polished state, and then add content and add new features and fix the crap out of everything during early access. And then when we're done actively developing it, launch out of early access.
Okay.
And so that's been our strategy. We've done the same thing for Infinifactory, TIS 100, and Shenzhen.
All right. So in that case, then, obviously Shenzhen is a quote-unquote finish in terms of content and stuff like that, I guess, other than like little...
Most likely.
Okay. Now, obviously, at this point, I'm assuming this next question is too soon to tell, but have you already started thinking about your next game for Zachtronics?
Oh, yes. That's what we're working on now. Yeah.
Do you have any teasers for people listening?
No. yeah, I don't want to build up hype that we can't deliver on. Yeah.
Oh, right.
It's it's probably going to launch in early access because, like we said, like it worked well for the past three games. I don't know why we wouldn't keep doing all that. Right.
I guess one last question, and then we'll move on to our final topic. As we talked about with your previous games, I know when we first spoke about Space Camp, you talked about how it got some appeal in the educational field. Like you were able to make, you were able to get into classrooms or have like specific versions for it. Has there been any talks about, like, from the educational side with a game like Shenzhen IO?
Yeah, I mean, so we've actually, so Space Camp, we give away, we tried to sell it to schools, but that was pretty pointless. Yeah. So we give it away for free, and we use it as a hook. So when somebody emails me to ask for a free copy of Space Camp for their schools, I upsell them on Infinifactory because it is a way better game for kids, right?
Yeah.
It's, barring the tone of the story, which we kind of toned down in the educational version, It's way more user friendly. I think it's just better in every way for a school environment than Space Chem. And so we use that to upsell Space Chem. We've sold an acceptable number of licenses for Infinifactory and TIS 100 to universities. Cool. And now that we have a DRM free version of Shenzhen out, I totally anticipate we'll do the same for that.
Awesome.
We really don't make a lot of money from it, but it's, you know, if somebody thinks they can use it in a classroom, that's great.
Yeah.
Like I think the games are interesting, and I think they're I don't know. we've talked a lot with people about like educational stuff, and we made a couple educational games, and like it's confusing. It's like a field that claims to be, you know, like kind of objective about like educate, like what the whole definition of like what is educational is actually like. Turns out like it goes kind of deep and it's kind of complicated, and so like our current stance on that kind of stuff is probably just like, eh, like if somebody wants to use it in a classroom, that's awesome, but not trying to force it, make it happen.
Yeah. I made a post a few weeks ago by the time folks are listening to this cast about like good games like as a gateway for people who don't play games. I did include your games on there as a great way for someone interested in that kind of programming or puzzle challenge. Because there are really interesting titles. Again, if you're able to learn them, you'll definitely get something out of them in terms of just improving your own thought process. But
yeah, we do have a fair number, I think, of non-gamers who play our games, which was kind of obvious in like support requests. So they're just like, I'm on Linux and my graphics drivers aren't installed or whatever. You know, like it's totally a game for people who, because not everybody has the patience for like a lot of things that games ask of you now. Like, oh, you need to grind on this stuff. And like, it's clearly like has no like, yeah, like it's you know, they don't. You had something you wrote about like the purpose, like people ask like with playing games, like, why am I playing this game? Is that our games answer that question in a somewhat novel way that some people respond to.
All right. I know, again, we could easily, between the two of us, we can easily sit here for like the next hour or two because we can easily jump off any topic. But let's move on to our final, I guess, part for this cast. I figure another 10 minutes. And I want to just focus a little bit more on early access. As we said, with your last three games, they've all gone the early access route. And I remember when we first spoke, I think way back when we first talked about Space Chem, I think you were one of the developers who were a little bit hesitant on going the early access model. But again, it's been a few years since, so it's maybe hard for me to remember. But
no, it's totally true. That was before I figured everything out.
Nice. So I guess that takes us to our first question. So for you, Zach, how have you found early access now that you've gone the whole process? You've done it three times, and as you just said, you're planning on doing it for number four at some
point.
Now
that I figured out the secret? Yeah. So I used to think that early access meant that you had to release your game in a crappy, broken, incomplete state that leaves your customers disappointed and confused, and if you have any sort of story in it, ruins it for them. Turns out you don't have to do that. And in fact, it turns out that even if your game does not fit the typical mold of early access titles, you can still call your game early access, and it does exactly what we want, which in this case is allowing us to get something out there and say, hey, we totally understand that this game is not like 100% what it should be. We haven't gotten the amount of feedback that we need in order to make it the best game it can be. And before, there wasn't really a way to say that, right? Mm-hmm. Before early access, like you put out a game and then everybody's like, oh, this game is released.
Yes.
You know, like we can start reviewing it immediately. Mm-hmm. If God forbid you have a patch like out at launch, they're like, oh, day one patches, this is garbage, right? Like releasing a game like has a lot of, like people assume a lot of things that might not be true, especially now with how like, I think game development now, especially in like the indie space and like the, you know, like low budget game development space and a digital space that like game, you know, like, games are more of a work in progress when they're out there. You know, people are make more changes to them after they've come out. Mm-hmm. And so we found that early access is a perhaps a better description for our games when they come out than saying it's not early access. Mm-hmm. And so what we do now is that all of our early access releases are of exactly the same quality, if not better, than Space Chem when it was launched, mm-hmm. right? And because we added a bunch of stuff to Space Chem, we made a lot of improvements after. It's what we do for all of our games. And so this has a little bit of confusion with people saying, like, oh, a lot of people feel like they've been burned. I shouldn't say a lot of people. Some people have said that they feel burned by early access, mm-hmm. right? And so they'll refuse to buy our early access games out of principle. But anytime, like, for any one person saying that, you'll have five other people popping in saying, like, oh, but Zachtronics, like, their early access, like, this game is very polished. Yeah. Like, they would have... They've said in the past that this would have been what they'd release as not early access, but they're just doing it because they're going to make it even better. And like we communicated that to our fans and they listen and they believe it. Mm-hmm. Right. And it's true. Yeah. Like I do think it's like we're not trying to pull any fast ones. Right. Like it's mm-hmm. so like I had incorrectly assumed in the past that to launch a game in early access would mean that like, oh, like, you know, like we're going to have like we have to get it out before the story is in there, which means that if somebody plays through it once, like they're going to miss all of our cool story stuff. It's like, no, like anything that's story of the game is 100% complete, you know, at least for like the initial part mm-hmm. of it, like is 100% complete for when we leave early access. And so like with Infinite Factory, like we nailed down like the entire story that we wanted, but then we left it open at the end and said like, oh, like what'll happen next? Who knows? Sort of like a crappy episodic game or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's been pretty, we did the same thing with Shenzhen and we did the same thing with all of them. And it's been pretty fun because we can tell a story like that we have like a strong idea for, and then we can like kind of, you know, like we can do an additional episode. We can wrap it up in a way that we would have never thought of before, mm-hmm. you know, like I don't want to spoil anything, but like in Shenzhen IO, like, you know, like the story of the game, you go to Shenzhen and like to work, but the like bonus campaign that we added is something that's like, it's like an aspirational thing that happens to the player. And it like, it ties in story wise with the fact that we solicited ideas for puzzles from the player, you know, from our players. And like, we were able to kind of like fuse like the release of the game and the story of the game together in a way that makes it interactive for like our, you know, our biggest fans, where they can participate in the story kind of, and we can do all these really exciting things. And so I think like figuring out how to do early access on our own terms was a huge deal, and it's changed the way we develop games for the better.
Yeah. I think that's a really good point there, Zach. It reminds me a lot of what I see from the studio Clay Entertainment and how they approach early access as well, that when they go on early access, their games are usually like 80 to 90% done. Like, you get a game, it's not, you're not going to see, you know, placeholder art in their games when they go on access. Exactly. They're pretty much like completed titles. It's just, again, about that last 10 to 20% of, you know, the polish of the game, making sure that
gotta take it up to 150%. Yes. Yeah, definitely.
And I think that's a very interesting point about early access. And as you said, the preconception of it varies between the consumer and even between some of the developers I've spoken to. I mean, over the last 2-3 years, I've spoken to developers who've gone early access with, as you said, like with a title that is just about finishing, it's just about the polish. And then there are people who go on early access with like literally, again, like alpha version 0.001. And they have a year to maybe even 2 to 3 years that they're going to be on early access and, you know, going the whole long-term development of it.
Yeah.
And I guess that is kind of the challenge. I guess I'm not sure. I guess in your opinion, Zach, with those kinds of games, the ones that are going to be on for years at a time, do you think, like, in your opinion, do you think they're still, like, viable in a sense as after, you know, the opinions of early access and your own process going through it for the last three games at this moment?
I think that's something you can only really know like after the mm-hmm. fact, right? Like if some people will do that and be successful, some people won't, some people could do it the opposite way and not be like, I don't think that actually, yeah. Like, I don't think that actually has a specific impact on whether or not you will be mm-hmm. successful. I think it's just like, it's easy to say when a game is not successful and does that, it's easy to blame that on it. But I don't actually know. Like, I suspect that there are other factors that are much bigger determinants of success or failure.
Okay. Now, here's a question that I'm curious about, and I'm sure any developers listening to this cast will probably ask this as well. As we said, you've definitely have shifted your development strategy using early access from the times of Space Chem. So my question for you, Zach, is, In terms of your own, like, design process of building your games, has, as you said, with how you've adjusted to early access, like, you're still releasing games in the same capacity as you would previously, but now, through early access, you're getting the opinions and the eyes on the game. When you're doing early access, has that changed or adjusted your own development process as you're building these games?
Yeah, I definitely think so. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm trying to think about, like, back to Space Camp. Like, in practice, I think we're kind of doing the same thing. Like, with Space Camp, we launched Space Camp. We definitely took in a bunch of feedback, and we kind of did the same thing we do now with our early access mm-hmm. games. I think the different thing is that now we're actually able to telegraph. We're able to quickly telegraph in a way that people understand, mm-hmm. yeah. right? And that's that going back to, like, you know, like what I was saying, like when you release a game that's not early access, people immediately assume it's people jump to the wrong conclusion mm-hmm. and assume that you thought it was done.
Yes.
And I think that whenever you have people like jump into the wrong conclusion, like, you know, they approach your game in a different way. Maybe they leave more negative reviews without thinking about it, without engaging, you know, and mm-hmm. it just sort of like it seems to be. So I guess like from a standpoint of what we do, we follow the same process, but it changes the way that our fans behave, which makes it easier for us to do our process. It makes it easier for us to incorporate, you know, people's feedback because it makes more willing. Like, they'll send us feedback saying, oh, I know the game's in early access, here are my suggestions, versus I bought this game and it's garbage.
Because of this.
Like, you know, like because of this, right? And it changes the way that we're able to engage with our fans by changing their behavior. And I think that like, I'm very happy with how our early access stuff works.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, again, about that perception of your game. And I've said this a few times on cast and post here, that when you put your game out and it's when you say your game is 1.0 or it's available on Steam, that creates that conception that it's done. You're looking at a finished product and should be judged and held to those standards accordingly. But when it has that early access tag and that little, you know, that big old early access description box,
mm-hmm.
it does present a different opportunity. You're telling people that you shouldn't be expecting a 100% game at this moment. Even if your game, as you said, when your games are on early access, they are definitely at a more finished and polished state compared to other people, but it's still not 100%. And I think that's kind of the key differentiator. It's the same thing. It can also lead to trouble with some games that, you know, they say that our game's not done, so anything and everything can happen kind of thing. Like, we've seen some developers, you know, pull the old 180. Like, all of a sudden their game's like this, and then, you know, halfway through they realize something's wrong, and then the whole game shifts away from what they originally intended.
Yeah, that's probably a hard thing to explain to people and have them be happy with. Yeah, in all honesty, I think it really comes down to the developer, right? Like, we were doing this before it had a name, mm-hmm. you know, we were doing it with Space Camp. I think that's why I'm okay with it now, mm-hmm. right? Is because we found a way that we can do it and actually do exactly what I wanted to do all along mm-hmm. and just call it something different, you know? And like, we try really hard to build up goodwill with our mm-hmm. fans, and I think that there's definitely people who do that and like, but burn, you know, like they burn their goodwill with their fans or they... Like I don't know. We try our best to have a good relationship with our fans to the degree that you can have a relationship with like an abstract group mm-hmm. of people. Like it's not really like real life, but it kind of is.
Yeah, and that's another easily jump off point for another topic. Again, about the transparency that we're seeing with the indie market, especially with developers who are using these new models. Again, early access, crowdfunding, Kickstarter, etc. And
yeah.
The fan base has definitely become a major factor of that. And again, if we start talking about that, that's another 20, 30 minutes easily. But I guess to start to wrap things up again, for those of you listening, we're not going to be hitting every aspect of early access today. But I guess for you, for people listening, as we said, like you've sort of quote-unquote found the secret of early access for yourself. For the developers listening to this cast, in your opinion, are there any like major elements of early access that you suggest someone does? And are there any major red flags that you figure out that someone should avoid doing when they put their game on early access?
No, I mean, to me, early access is nothing other than like a label mm-hmm. that you can put on your Steam page, right? Like that's it. Okay. Like, it's not a system, it's not a process, there's no rules at all. There are no rules to it, I'm pretty sure, other than, like, a couple, like, specific, like, after your game leaves early access, you can't put it on sale for, like, 3 weeks or whatever Steam and for, like, you know, like, they have, like, there's a few technical details of early access. For the most part, there's not, right? And it really is just a, I think maybe fans think that there's more to it than that, but, like, it's just a label that if you check a box, it shows up on your Steam store page. And I think that's important to think, like, it's important to realize that's the reality, to understand it. And like I said, no, I don't think there's any advice that the developers should follow if they're in early access, they shouldn't follow otherwise.
All
right. And in fact, I'd be loath to encourage developers to do or not do anything just because game development is like super subjective and not scientific and no one knows what they're doing and no one knows how to be successful.
Yes.
You just hope for the best. Don't be an asshole. That's universally true.
Yeah, definitely. I guess this last question, and I think I know the answer to it already, but I just want to reiterate here for people listening. So, as we said, with your development style and releasing games or putting them on early access, they are very much in that same state as you would release them otherwise in the past. I guess my question for you, Zach, is how do you, like, what are your, I guess, factors that tell you, okay, it's time to put this game on early access, or maybe we need to spend another 2-3 weeks working on before we do that?
Yeah, for us, we don't really think about it in terms of time, right? So I would never say, like, we need another 3 weeks on this project. It would be like, we need X, we need this feature, we need some art for this, we need to do these specific things, and it turns out those might take 2 to 3 weeks.
Okay.
Yeah. Right? I think that, like, kind of from a scheduling, like, a process standpoint, saying, like, thinking about it in terms of just, like, dumping time in as if it's an abstract resource is a poor use of time, right? Like, if you don't know what you're doing with your time, then, like, you probably shouldn't be spending it, right? So for us, it's like at the end of Shinjaneo, we had a list of features, and then we're just like, okay, like, these are, you know, if we wanted to ship, like, really soon, like, which of these features do we really need? Mm-hmm. Which of these features can we do after? Like, originally, we had a lot more advanced things planned for the custom LCD screens, but instead, we, like, slipped in a really simple version, like, literally the night before we launched, right? I'm just like, you know what? This is good enough. And it turned out it was good enough, right? And so I think it's always about the features to us, not about time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a really good way of looking. Again, if you understand what the feature is, you have a good estimate of what the time is if you know what you're doing. And again, it's just about getting what you want into the game. And that is a very good lesson, especially for developers listening, that you have to understand just what your game is about and then build accordingly. If you don't have a game plan or a set of what I want my game to have this, 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 and this, if you're just, you know, throwing things against the wall, it's going to balloon that project out, and it leads to a lot of the troubles that we could easily talk about.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the magic of production. Yeah. That's
great. All right. We're about to hit 50 minutes in, and I know you have to get going, so we will wrap it up here. Again, we can easily talk about who knows what else tonight. We could probably talk all the way through to Thanksgiving if we're not careful. But let's wrap it up here. I guess before we end things for today, I guess just two final questions to end the cast on. I guess the first one is, as you say, you are working on a new game and you can't reveal any teasers, but there's just one thing I gotta ask. Are we going to have to print out another manual for your next game?
Ooh, it depends. Hopefully.
Nice.
I don't know. I'm not sure. It's not. We're not going in with that as one of the explicit goals like we did with Shenzhen. But it's. I do think it's fun. I do like the whole, like, the. I like the idea of, like, an indie feely renaissance. But we'll see. There's no point in trying to force something that's not appropriate for a game.
And that just reminded me of one other question I just want to ask very quickly. In terms of writing the manual for Shenzhen, how did you, like, I guess, approach writing? Because as we talked about over this cast, the manual itself kind of became its own character and its own puzzles for the game.
Oh, yeah. It was written alongside the game at the same time throughout development. The two informed each other, and it was written by pretty much everyone, right? Like, we have an actual writer who wrote a lot of the fluff. I wrote a lot of the technical design stuff. One of our programmers wrote the actual language specification to get that real language programmer specification vibe for it. Yeah, like, it's a very important part of the game design, and it was implemented as such.
Awesome. All right, in that case, my final question then for you, Zach, as I always like to end these casts on, do you have any final thoughts or anything you'd like to say to the fans listening to end the cast on?
Oh, we should buy our games. At least check them out.
Yes. I was
they're okay. They're pretty good.
I was telling people on my YouTube channel that one of the votes for a Let's Play for 1000 would be like plays of like Zachtronics games. I go, that will probably blow my brain up if I try to play them all in one sitting. Just get through them all as quickly as possible. I go, I just feel my brain overheating thinking about that.
Yeah, we do not encourage that.
Yeah. That's not good. All right. Again, Zach, it was a pleasure hanging out with you today. Hopefully we can talk again in less than a year from our last time.
Yeah, I hope so, yeah.
All right. So with all that said, we're going to end things here. Once again, Zach, thank you so much for coming on, and congratulations with Shenzhen. And I can't wait to see whatever crazy machinations you have next with your mysterious game.
That's the goal.
All right. So for those of you listening, we're going to end the cast here. Thank you so much for tuning in. As always, if you'd like to support Game Wisdom, we have a few options available. If you'd like to write a guest piece for the site or be a future guest, whether it's a podcast or a live talk, you can find information and links under Submissions Wanted on the front page. If you'd like to follow me, you can find me on Twitter at GWBicer. And I'm also on Twitch under GWBicer as well. Be sure to check out the Game Wisdom YouTube channel that is growing quite rapidly. You can find me on YouTube under Game Wisdom, and there are daily videos on games as well as game design discussions. And last but not least, be sure to check out the Patreon campaign. You can find me on there under Game Wisdom. Donations will be greatly appreciated. They will allow me to keep doing what I'm doing while supporting myself. And when we hit some goals, it'll mean more content for everyone to enjoy. So, once again, Zach, thank you so much for coming on. Hope you have a great Thanksgiving tomorrow, and let's definitely talk again real soon.
Yeah, thanks.
All right. Thanks again, folks, for listening to this week's edition of the Perceptive Podcast. Obviously, by the time you're hearing this, it will be way past Thanksgiving, so I hope you had a great Thanksgiving, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care.